the fugitive North Koreans in Shenyang. So many were hiding that every few months the police launched a city-wide sweep to catch them and send them back. At a birthday party for one of the waitresses, I heard a girl whose Mandarin was so halting that I guessed she was North Korean. I introduced myself. Gradually and discreetly, I got to know several other North Korean girls, all of them, like me, hiding in plain sight. The girl I'd met at the birthday party was called Soojin. She had an oval face, large eyes, and full, bow-shaped red lips, considered very beautiful in North Korea. She, too, was a waitress. I began to enjoy long chats with her on the phone once or twice a week. She was living in Shenyang with her South Korean boyfriend. Living with a South Korean boyfriend. I was scandalized when she told me that, and thrilled. But after a few weeks, her calls suddenly stopped. When I called her phone, I got a number discontinued tone. I sensed disaster in it. 6 months later, I thought I spotted Soojin in the street in Koreatown after dark, but I wasn't sure. I called her name, and a face turned towards me with a haunted look, like an animal caught ferreting in trash. It was her. Her features had grown thin and drawn. I could see her shoulder bones poking through her T-shirt. Far from being happy to see me, her eyes were darting about, as if she thought she was being followed. She said the police had come to her apartment and asked for her ID. She didn't have one. They arrested her and processed her at the Shita Road police station, then deported her back to North Korea. She was imprisoned for 3 months in a Puibu holding camp. Hygiene was non-existent, and each meal consisted of 10 kernels of corn. New arrivals quickly contracted diarrhea, which, with starvation rations, killed many in a matter of days. On her release, she was made to sign a document vowing never to escape again. She knew that if she was caught a second time, she would not survive the punishment. Scars from kicks and beatings were livid on her legs. She said that China was too dangerous for her now. She was determined to go to South Korea. Soojin was desperate to keep a low profile. She was convinced that she had been betrayed by a mutual North Korean friend of ours in Shenyang called Chunhee, who she believed had been let off by the Chinese police in exchange for becoming an informer. Soojin squeezed my hand. Xinjiang, be careful. I watched her go. I never saw her again. What Soojin told me spooked me and made me paranoid about informers. How many knew I was North Korean? I kept going over and over this. Whom had I told? Even then, I didn't see disaster coming. A week later, the receptionist at the restaurant called my cell phone at about 10 in the morning. It was my day off, and I was in the dormitory. Two good-looking young men were in the restaurant, she said, sounding upbeat. They've asked for you by name. My heart leapt. No one ever asked for me by name, but I had given my name to the two South Korean filmmakers. Ask them to wait, I said. I'll be right there. I put on some makeup and rushed to the restaurant. At that time of the morning, there were few customers. The receptionist pointed to a table. Two men I did not recognize stood up. Sun Hyang? One of them said. Yes? They opened their jackets to reveal their warrant badges. Police, you're coming with us. Chapter 26. Interrogation. The two plainclothes officers escorted me outside to an unmarked BMW. I felt hazily detached from reality, as if this was some bad daydream. They did not cuff me. They seemed relaxed, as if they'd done this many times. One of them was extraordinarily handsome, I noticed, like a movie actor. A third man was sitting in the driver's seat. I sat between two men in the back. Where are we going? I said. The handsome one answered. Shita Road Station. The car's aircon was chilling me. My teeth began to chatter. It's over, I thought. There was no possible way out of this. As we sped through the familiar streets of Shita, I thought of the awful trouble my family would be in once the Puibu found out I'd been in China. It was my mother and Mino I was fearful for, not for myself. I deserved this. I had done this to myself. I linked my fingers in my lap, and for the first time in my life, I prayed. I belonged to no faith, so I prayed to the spirits of my ancestors. If this is another nightmare, let me wake up. I prayed to the spirit of my dear father. If you can, please help me now. The car pulled over in front of the station. The officers walked either side of me into a reception area lit by fluorescent lighting. It was busy, with people in uniform and civilian clothes coming and going. To the left, I saw what looked like a temporary holding cell with floor-to-ceiling bars. At least 30 people crammed into the space, leaning against the wall or sitting on the floor. Men and women together, silent, with blank, resigned faces. Some of them were very thin. They stared at me. They looked North Korean. I felt no pity for them. I felt nothing. In a few minutes I'll be joining you. We passed a desk where a 1 or 2 month old baby lay wrapped in a blanket. It was crying and unattended. My legs turned to straw. The two policemen led me upstairs. On the second floor, we entered a large, bright conference room. 20 or so police officers in pale blue shirts stood about, leaning against the wall. All watched me as I came in. The handsome officer politely offered me a chair facing a desk, then sat behind it between two other male officials. The scene was surreal and like a dream, relaxed, yet menacing. The handsome officer introduced himself as Inspector Shu. He was to be my interrogator. It was happening here. I was surrounded. Focus, I told myself. Pay attention only to what is crucial, the three men behind the desk. Forget the others watching me. Inspector Shu was not the only one asking the questions. The other two also took turns to interrogate me in Mandarin. What is your family name? Where were you born? Your parents' names? Their occupations? Their precise address? The names of your siblings? I told them I was the daughter of Uncle Junggi and Aunt Sanghee in Shenyang, and gave all their details. I need your family's home phone number, one of the officials said. Sirens went off in my head. I could not risk them phoning my uncle and aunt. We don't have one now. My parents cancelled it because they're staying in South Korea for a while. Which elementary school did you attend? What was the headmaster's name? My mind dredged up every shred of information I could recall from conversations with Gunsu and his sisters about their schooling in Shenyang. Your secondary school? Which one? My heart was beating wildly, but I forced myself to remain calm. My body went into a kind of emergency operating mode. It was almost as if I was not there. They're watching to see if I'm lying. Don't show them. Speak clearly and with confidence. Nervousness began to show in my fingers. I was clutching my hands together in my lap. They would notice that. I stilled my fingers. Back to your parents. What is your father's date of birth? Your mother's? And then casually, as if asking the day of the week, when is Kim Il-sung's birthday? April the 15th. A question any North Korean could answer without thinking. I have absolutely no idea, I said. The questioning moved on to a new phase. Inspector Shu asked me when I would get married. I thought there might be a trap in the question. Not for 10 years yet, I said. My laugh sounded fake. I'm too young. The police standing behind me observed the whole scene in silence. No one came into the room. No one left. Inspector Shu was watching me carefully, twirling his pen in his fingers. Next, he slid a copy of the Shenyang Daily across the desk and told me to start reading the first article. It was about a traffic pile-up on the Shendar Expressway. By this time, my Mandarin sounded neutral. I was fairly sure that I spoke without a trace of a North Korean accent. After a minute or two, he said, "Enough!" I noticed that so far nobody had entered any of the answers I had given into the computer on the desk. They've got doubts. They think I may be Chinese. Next was a written test in Chinese. One of the interrogators dictated from the newspaper and stood behind me as I wrote down his words. When I'd done that, one of them said,
"Where's your ID?"
"It's at home." When Gunsu had showed me the ID card his family had made for me, I had memorized the ID number. I gave it to them. The ID system was still paper-based. Checking the number would require a call to another station, which would have to retrieve a file. If they think I'm North Korean, they'll start checking properly now. Then that's the end. Instead, the atmosphere in the room lightened. The suspicion was draining from their faces. Inspector Xu smiled for the first time.
"So, when are you really getting married?"
I laughed again.
"When the best offer comes along."
One of the interrogators flipped his notebook shut. I heard him say to the other,
"False report."
So, someone had reported me. Inspector Xu stood up.
"You're free to go," he said, with a sweep of his arm toward the door. "Sorry to take up your time. We had to follow procedure."
I walked to the door in a daze, under the eyes of all the police in the room. And just like in a dream, I expected to hear,
"Ah, one last thing."
The door closed behind me. I rushed down the stairs, across the reception area, and past the holding cell. I could not bear to look at the people locked in there. I walked out into the sunshine and the bustle of the street. Once I was several blocks away from the station, I slowed and stopped for a minute on the sidewalk. It was a clear, warm morning. Business was carrying on as usual in Shita. Pedestrians flowed around me. I looked up. An airplane was tracing its way across the blue, like a tiny silver minnow. "Thank you, my dear father, with all my heart. Thank you for making me study Chinese for all that time at school." Chinese characters take years to master. That final test had dispelled the last doubts in their minds. My father had saved me. I knew now that time was running out for me in Shenyang. I could not stay. It was too dangerous. Until I figured out where to go, I would hide. I would move out of the dorm. But to where? Nowhere in the city was safe from the police. As I walked, my relief began turning into depression. I was already hiding beneath so many lies that I hardly knew who I was anymore. I was becoming a non-person. The experience I'd just had was deeply dehumanizing. A police bureaucracy, with its correct procedures and trick questions, and inspectors in press shirts, thought it reasonable and right to send people from my country to a Puibu torture cell for beatings with wire cables. I clasped my hands to my head. How could I have been so stupid telling anyone I was from North Korea? Now I had no one I could trust, and nowhere I could feel protected. The moment I thought that, an idea occurred to me. If the net for catching escaped North Koreans was cast from the Shita Road police station, then I would move right next to it. No one would imagine that a fugitive would live next to the very place where the roundups were planned. The darkest spot is right beneath the candle. A few days later, I rented a one-room apartment next door to the Shita Road police station. In fact, the distance from the entrance of my new apartment building to the station was about 5 steps. From my window, I could see some of the police from the interrogation room coming and going in their dark blue uniforms. I was so close that I figured they wouldn't bother with my block, even on one of their most thorough roundups. 2 weeks after I had moved there, I was returning home after a long day at the restaurant. I was so tired it was an effort to climb the stairs. I felt in the bottom of my bag for the keys to my door. The stairwell had no light. Suddenly I heard the sound of a rapid movement in the darkness to my left, as if something were rushing toward me. Before I could react,
A massive blow struck the back of my head. The explosion in my ears stunned my brain. My vision went blank. Then I blacked out. Chapter 27. The Plan. I opened my eyes to a diffuse white light. I was lying on my side on a bed. Pain pulsed from the back of my head. I felt nauseous. A soft-spoken female voice asked me to look at her. I turned my eyes slightly and saw a lady in a green surgical mask. The gash in my head required 10 stitches, she said. I was being given an anaesthetic and would be going under for half an hour. If I don't wake up, no one will know who I am, I thought. The girl with many names and no identity. My eyes began to droop. It was a couple of days before I could piece together what had happened. My neighbour in the apartment block had heard a noise in the stairwell. She found me lying on the concrete floor. A widening pool of blood was flowing from the back of my skull. The attacker had smashed a full 1 liter beer bottle over my head and had run off. Someone had been waiting for me in the dark, intending to attack me with such violence that the blow might have been fatal. Whoever it was didn't take my wallet or the keys out of my hand to rob my apartment. I had been very lucky that my attacker had not drunk the beer first, the hospital staff said. The glass of an empty bottle would have done far more damage. They urged me to report to the police as soon as possible. I said I would, but I had no intention of talking to the police. My old dorm friend, Jiu, thought the family of my jilted ex-fiancé was behind the attack. Mrs. Jiang might have been seeking to avenge the family's honour for my humiliation on Gunsu before the wedding. This thought troubled me very much. But the more I considered it, the less likely it seemed. The manner of the attack and the choice of weapon, a 1 liter bottle of beer, wasn't something the family would stoop to. I credited Mrs. Jiang with more class. The timing, just 2 weeks after my police interrogation, suggested that it was more likely to be connected to the informer who told the police I was a North Korean and who provided them with my name and place of work. This is speculation, but the informer might have suffered consequences for wasting police time with a false report and was taking revenge. Once I was on the mend, I went back to work at the restaurant, but I was no longer enjoying the job. The comfort of my routine had been shattered. I was now mistrustful of everyone. I became paranoid whenever a customer tried to chat with me. I missed my family more than ever. I longed for my mother's affection. I wanted to cry in her arms after what had happened to me. I longed for Mino's company. There was not an hour of the day when I did not think about them. Before the police interrogation, I had started to make friends in Chunyang, but now I kept to myself. Once again, I was alone. In my new neighbourhood, I found myself using the same laundry as some of the policemen. Sometimes I saw the handsome Inspector Xu. He didn't recognize me. One of the regulars in the laundry was a Korean-Chinese officer who always smiled at me. I tried to think whether he'd been in the background when I'd been interrogated, but I wasn't sure, and I couldn't ask. He seemed nice. His name was Xin Jin Su, and he held the rank of sergeant. He was a little older than me. Not good-looking, but impressive in his uniform. One evening in the laundry, he asked if I'd like to have dinner. My instinct was to smile and decline, but after all that had happened in the last few weeks, I was frightened and cynical. A voice in my head said, "Why not? A policeman ally could be useful." We began dating. It was the autumn of 2001. Our dates were nothing fancy. We'd go to a McDonald's or a KFC. One evening, he seemed tired but in high spirits. "I'm exhausted," he said, "and starving." He was stuffing a Big Mac and fries into his mouth and wiping the grease from his lips with the back of his hand. "Why?" "Rounding up North Koreans since dawn." His mouth was full. "We got so many I had to skip lunch." He described how some of them cried and begged when they were cornered. and seemed to think I'd find this as funny as he did.
"Please don't send me back,"
he said, putting on a high-pitched North Korean accent. I had to control my face to hide my anger. "The woman you're looking at is one of them, you bastard." I knew I had no real affection for him, that I was using him for protection. But far from being clever, I realized I was courting danger. I would have to end my relationship with Police Sergeant Shindin Su. But while I sat there listening to him boast about his role in the roundups, it gave me satisfaction to know that I finally had a North Korean plan of my own. Almost 4 years had passed since that final call from my mother. On each anniversary of that date, a valve in my heart would open and flood me with sadness. But as the fourth anniversary approached, in the winter of 2001, I had hope for the first time. 4 years of frugal living meant that I had saved enough to pay a broker to find my family in Haesan. Even if a reunion with them could not be arranged, I was desperate to get a message to them, to tell them I was alive and thinking of them every day, to ask if they were safe, to say I love them very much. I had no choice but to travel to Chiang Mai, turn up at Mr. Ahn's house, and hope the Ahn family still lived there. Their phone number had not been in service for years. This is why I also formed a plan B. A wealthy Korean-Chinese businessman who came to the restaurant for dinner most weeks often chatted to me. He was generous and much liked by the staff. One evening he noticed that I seemed low. He was relaxing after dinner with a cigarette and a whiskey. On an impulse, I told him I had relatives in North Korea that I needed to speak to.
"Why didn't you tell me sooner?" he said. "I have contacts. I know people."
He discreetly introduced me to a Chinese broker with experience of getting people out of North Korea, those who could afford his fee. He was a small, tough man. He seemed honest. He spoke in the cautious manner of someone with a realistic attitude to risk. But I also thought I would not want to get on the wrong side of him. He asked me what I wanted to achieve. "A reunion with my mother and brother," I said. I reasoned that having this second channel would increase my chances of success. Plan B would turn out to be a disastrous mistake. Chapter 28. The Gang. The frail woman who opened the door was Mrs. Ahn. In 4 years, she had aged a decade. She clasped her hands to her mouth when she saw me, and told me on the doorstep that Mr. Ahn was very sick, bedridden, and unable to stand without help. His jolly fat fish face was unrecognizable. It was contorted in pain. He had difficulty speaking. Mrs. Ahn explained that North Korean border guards had caught him delivering contraband on the Haesan side of the river, bundled him into a sack, and took him to their station. They said they knew he helped people to escape, and beat him black and blue. They knew he wouldn't say a thing to the Chinese police because he was a smuggler.
"He should never have gone back over there after that," Mrs. Ahn said.
But he did, and was almost caught a second time when the guards spotted him. They aimed a shot at him as he fled back over the river, and he suffered a gunshot wound to his arm. On top of his injury, he now had severe diabetes. This was shocking enough, but her next piece of news horrified me. Their next-door neighbour, Mr. Chang, who had been so angry that time I phoned him, had been convicted of selling North Korean women as brides and prostitutes for Chinese men. That explained his reaction to my call. He was under investigation by the Chinese police at the time. He died soon after starting a 10-year prison sentence, and his wife had gone insane. Mr. Chang was a human trafficker. To think that I had almost knocked on his door that night after crossing the river, but instead chose Mr. Ahn. Mrs. Ahn had no news of my family. Mino had not visited in years. Cross-river trade had gone quiet for a long while, she said, since an event that had occurred 2 years ago, in 1999. The party chief of Haesan had complained to Kim Jong-il that the city was becoming a hotbed of capitalism, and a brutal crackdown was ordered by Pyongyang. Many traders were arrested, and executed in people's trials at Haesan Airport. I felt sick suddenly. I had never thought that my mother and Mino might be dead. Mrs. Ahn's kindness had not changed. She said she would get one of the smugglers to search my family, and if he found them, arrange for Mino to come to the river and meet me in Chiang Bai. I said I would pay the smuggler a fee. It was dark when I had arrived, and dark when I left early the next morning. I did not see Haesan across the river, but I sensed its presence. I smelt it. The Yuntan smoke and fresh-cut lumber. The unearthly stillness. All I could do now was return to Shenyang, go back to work, and wait. On a freezing cold Saturday morning a few weeks later, I was in my apartment when Mrs. Ahn called. She said the smuggler had located my family, and Mino had crossed the river. What she said next made me almost scream in her ear.
"He's standing right here."
There was a fumbling sound as she handed over the phone. "Hello?" a voice said. I held my breath. Who is this? "Nuna, it's me," the voice said, using the Korean word a boy uses for an older sister. Something was wrong. It sounded nothing like Mino. I turned to the window. I was picturing my brother in the reflection of the glass. When I'd last seen him, he was a boy of 10. Now he was 14. "Nuna, trust me," the voice said. "Do you remember the time I sneaked over here in the school vacation and couldn't get back because the river flooded?" Finally, I exhaled. "It's him." I began to giggle stupidly and cry at the same time. I felt such a surge of love for him. "Your voice is so changed," was all I could manage to say.
"So is yours."
On the way to the train station, I withdrew all my savings and converted it into US dollars. It came to about $800. Some of this I would use to pay to Mrs. Ahn's smuggler as a fee. The rest I would give to my brother and mother. I thought dollars would be handier for them to use as bribes in North Korea. I took the train from Shenyang to Changchun, then the bus to Chiang Bai. It was expensive, but much quicker. On the fast, silent train, watching the hills slip by, my mind was filling with elated thoughts of seeing Mino, when my phone rang again. A man's voice said,
"My men have found your family."
It was the Chinese broker. That took the smile off my face. I had almost forgotten about Plan B. It seemed the most absurd bad luck that both channels had worked and I would now have to pay for both.
"When will you come to Chiang Bai?"
"Tomorrow," I lied. When I arrived at the Ahn's house, a young man was sitting at Mr. Ahn's bedside. He stood up when he saw me. Whenever I thought of Mino, I saw the smooth-faced kid brother with the cute grin. This young man looked nothing like him. He was taller and fuller, but I recognized my mother's face in his. He was staring at me with intense curiosity. Then he gave that grin I remembered, as if to say, "See? Not a kid anymore." To him I appeared very strange. I was wearing tight jeans and had brown highlights in my hair, a style truly alien in North Korea. We studied each other across Mr. Ahn's living room, taking each other in, as if across an expanse of years.
"It's really you," I said.
"Yes."
He spoke with a man's voice. Then we both laughed at the same time, came together, and I hugged his face to mine. I could not believe I had my brother in my arms. Before I'd even had a chance to ask about our mother, a knock sounded on the front door. Mrs. Ahn opened it. Four men were outside. I knew the moment I saw them that I had trouble. They were dressed in black jackets and jeans. One of them had face piercings. These were not locals from Chiang Bai. They were from a gang.
Are you Sun Xiang?
One of them called, spotting me behind Mrs. An. He had a shaved head.
We're the ones who found your family.
The Chinese broker hired these thugs. I stepped outside to face them and tried to keep the alarm out of my voice. I'll be in touch with you tomorrow, I said.
No, you have to come with us now,
the shaven-headed one said.
Don't worry, everything will be fine.
Mrs. An looked shocked. I left my phone and my bag and went with them. Mino wanted to come. I told him to stay. I had to handle this. The men took me to an unfurnished apartment in a block on the other side of Chiang Bai. The shaven-headed one led me into a bare room and closed the door. He stood so close I could feel his breath and spoke directly into my face.
We found your family. Your mother said your brother had already left to meet you at that old man Arn's house. Whether you needed us or not makes no difference to me. We've done our part. Now you pay.
How much?
70,000 yuan.
My blood froze. That was almost $8,500, and many, many times more than I had. I don't have that kind of money.
Your rich-ass businessman friend in Shenyang is paying, he said. The broker was clear about that.
He handed me a cell phone.
Call the businessman. Tell him to transfer the money.
My heart sank to my stomach. As misunderstandings went, this one couldn't be bigger. This has nothing to do with the businessman, I said. I'm the one who has to pay. He was just being helpful. I hardly know him. I can't ask him for money.
Then you have a problem.
What problem?
I'll put it this way. If you don't pay, we'll take you back to North Korea.
Chapter 29. The Comfort of Moonlight. Sympathetic people I'd met in China would sometimes express their bewilderment that the Kim dynasty had been tyrannizing North Korea for almost 6 decades. How does that family get away with it? Just as baffling, how do their subjects go on coping? In truth, there is no dividing line between cruel leaders and oppressed citizens. The Kims rule by making everyone complicit in a brutal system, implicating all, from the highest to the lowest, blurring morals so that no one is blameless. A terrorized party cadre would terrorize his subordinates, and so on down the chain. A friend will inform on a friend out of fear of punishment for not informing. A nicely brought up boy will become a guard, who kicks to death a girl caught trying to escape to China, because her songbun has sank to the bottom of the heap, and she's worthless and hostile in the eyes of the state. Ordinary people are made persecutors, denouncers, thieves. They use the fear flowing from the top to win some advantage, or to survive. Although he was Chinese, and not from North Korea, I was seeing a prime example in this criminal in front of me, standing inches from my face. He had it in his power to rescue people, to be a hero. Instead, he was using the terror of the regime to benefit himself and add to the misery of others. He had me on a cliff edge. Pay me. Or I push. I said it again. I don't have that kind of money. If you can reduce the fee, I'll see what I can do. But if you can't, there's nothing I can do. I felt utterly resigned. He must have seen it in my eyes, because he left me alone and conferred with the others. The apartment had cheap plaster walls. I could hear most of what was spoken in the next room.
If you want money from her, you can't touch her, one of them said.
Shavenhead came back into the room. He said I would have to stay here until a solution was found. He would send to Mr. An's for my bag. I hoped the neutral look on my face hid my panic. My phone and all my cash were in that bag. I did not want them to get their hands on the cash, or I'd have nothing to give Mino and my mother, or to Mrs. Arne for the smuggler's fee. I asked Shavenhead if I could use his phone. He told me to talk in front of him so he could hear what I was saying. I called my own phone's number, but no one at Mrs. Arne's answered it. I called it again, and again. Shavenhead lost interest and went to talk to the others.
Come on, please. Someone answer.
Mino later told me that he and Mr. Arne had heard the phone ringing, but couldn't see what to press to answer it. Neither of them had seen a cell phone before. Finally, they figured it out. Mino answered. In a low, urgent voice, I told him to leave the wallet in my bag but take out all the cash, pay Mrs. Arne the smuggler's fee, and go as quickly as he could back across the river to Haysam. One of the gang returned with my bag. Mino had done as I had asked. Later that day, Shavenhead lowered the gang's fee to 60,000 yuan, $7,250, and told me not to even think of leaving until it was paid. There was no lock on the room where they kept me, so they took turns to guard me outside the door, while others slept in the room connected to the only exit. Escape was impossible. That evening, one of them brought back a takeaway meal of skewered lamb and dumplings. My hope was that if I held out, they would continue to lower the fee. I was too ashamed to play the only card I had, calling my aunt and uncle in Shenyang. I thought I would rather face my fate in North Korea. After the disrespect I had shown them, how could I ask them to pay a fortune to a criminal gang? I played for time, telling Shavenhead I was messaging people, appealing to various contacts to see if I could raise the money. By the third evening, they'd had enough of takeaways and took me to a local restaurant, where I was wedged between two of them in a dining booth. I can't imagine what other customers thought I was doing with these thugs. The gang knew that an illegal like me wouldn't try anything stupid, like calling for help. If I did, I'd be in even worse trouble. From their accents, I knew the one with fake piercings was Han Chinese. He scared me the most. Violence crackled about him like static. I tried to avoid his eye. He kept looking at me in the way that made me feel naked. Two of the others were Korean Chinese. They were more normal in appearance. I gathered that they were from a gang based in Yanji. They also dealt in fake leather goods and amphetamines. They were respectful towards Shavenhead. I couldn't place his accent. Dandong, maybe. Later, after they closed the door on me in the bare room, they opened beers and toasted each other with shots of soju. I heard the constant flick of a lighter and guessed they were smoking a drug. Whatever it wasn't calming them. The talk became competitive and aggressive, and soon turned ominously coarse. My stomach began to knot. Then the one with the face piercings reminded them that they had a 21-year-old girl in the next room. There was silence for a moment. I heard him say, "What's she gonna do?" "Please, no." Until this moment, I'd been in that strange, calm emergency mode I'd been in the Shita Road police station, keeping my fear under control, as if I wasn't quite there. Now I was losing it. My breathing became shallow. My body began trembling and refused to stop. If they entered the room now, I would start screaming. I heard movement, as if they were getting up off the floor. I pressed myself into a corner. I would beg and plead. They were talking again. Face piercings asked why the hell they were treating me so well. One of the Korean Chinese said, "She's like our client. If you mess her up, we might lose the fee." One of the others murmured agreement. Shavenhead remained silent. There was another toast of soju. Face piercing seemed to back down. The conversation moved on. All night I remained crouched in the corner with my arms around my knees, not daring to move, watching the moon's progress across the window pane, silken and faint behind cloud, like a moth cocoon. It was the same moon my mother and Mino could see. I told myself that if I stayed in its light, I would be safe. Safe. I thought of my policeman boyfriend in Shenyang, Sergeant Xin Jinsu. I wondered what he'd do if I asked him for help, if I told him the truth about me. The thought of the shock on his face almost made me smile. At first light, I called my uncle in Shenyang. It was the first time I had spoken to him since fleeing his apartment. My voice was fragile with fear and shame. I asked him to help me. I told him I would devote my life to repaying him. He said, "I'll do it at once." He would transfer the money to the gang's account. I tried to thank him, but the words choked in my throat. He had my father's genes, and the same love and generosity my father had shown me. We had to wait 2 days for the money to clear. I noticed that the two Korean Chinese took turns to guard me in the next room, not face piercings. They didn't trust him. I was grateful to them for that. After almost a week as their prisoner, the gang took me with them to the bank in Changbai and withdrew the money. Face Piercing's eyes shone when he saw the thick wads of red 100 yuan bills in an envelope. He clasped the others by the shoulders and pulled them towards him.
"Oh, we did well."
Shavenhead took me to the coach station. Before he left, he held out his hand and said, "Give me your fucking phone." I gave it to him. When he'd gone, I reached into a hidden pocket in the lining of my long winter coat and retrieved some money I had hidden there in a tight roll. I used it to buy a bus ticket for Shenyang. On the journey back, I rested my head on the cold glass of the window and stared out at a world of white, an empty dimension. 60,000 yuan, a fortune representing 10 years' wages at the restaurant, and a week's imprisonment with the threat of rape, and all I'd achieved was a 3-minute reunion with Mino. But I had made contact with my family. I knew they were alive and not in prison, and they knew that I was alive, and that, somehow, I was fine. With the stress of my ordeals, not to mention the debt that would take me decades to repay, I fell sick once I got back to my apartment and developed such painful mouth ulcers I found it hard to eat or drink. I was anxious and paranoid. I wanted to get out of Shenyang, fast. I had an idea of where I would go, but thinking of what my mother would do, I visited a fortune teller for good luck.
"If you move," the lady said, pausing for effect, "you should go south, to a warmer place."
"Such as Shanghai?" I did not care that I was prompting her with the response I wanted. She pronounced her next words with an air of profound wisdom, as if she hadn't heard me.
"The best place for you would be Shanghai."
That was all the confirmation I needed. I gave notice on my apartment. I quit my job at the restaurant. I was about to call Police Sergeant Xin Jinsu to arrange a final meeting and tell him our relationship was over, but changed my mind. He'd soon figure that out for himself. Just days into January 2002, I packed everything I had into 2 light bags, bought a 1-way ticket to Shanghai, and boarded the fast train. Chapter 30. The Biggest, Brashest City in Asia. I took the train with a Korean-Chinese acquaintance of mine named Ian, who was also moving to Shanghai. She was a waitress I'd met once or twice. I noticed that she avoided the subject of her past, which was fine by me. I told her nothing of mine. I guessed we were both running away from something. She was good-natured, with a blunt manner and a foghorn voice. I liked her. When we talked of how we would get by in Shanghai, we both had the same thought at once. We could share an apartment. The moment we agreed on it, I felt the tension and anxiety that had been in me for weeks begin to dissolve. Sharing with Ian meant I would not have to cope with everything alone all over again.
We were both almost penniless, but now starting anew didn't seem so daunting. We were laughing over the fact that we'd been eating nothing but instant noodles until we found work, when I saw a forest green police uniform and cap enter the far end of the long carriage, and people reaching for jackets and wallets. They were holding up their IDs. Beads of cold sweat broke out on my brow. I knew that these checks sometimes happened on buses and trains, but until now I'd been lucky. The policeman was examining each one with a nod, moving along the rows, coming closer. He was 15 yards away. What to do? My chest felt as if it was stuffed with hot wool. Panic was rising in me. Ian's mouth was moving. I heard her voice as if it were underwater. Sun Hyang, I said, are you all right? Bit travel sick, I said, and shot out of my seat. I locked the door of the toilet and waited, listening to a rushing, keening noise as the train entered a long tunnel and picked up speed. When I emerged after almost an hour, I peeped into the carriages to the left and the right. The policeman had gone. I found Ian asleep in her seat. For the rest of the journey, I sat upright and alert, my stomach clenching with nerves. The train approached Shanghai Station at dawn. Against a feathered peach sky, I glimpsed the faint outlines of towers half a kilometre high, the skyline of Pudong. Maybe it was because I was hearing snatches of Shanghainese and other dialects around me in the carriage, but it didn't feel like I was even in China anymore. Many of the passengers disembarking with huge holdalls and rucksacks were people like Ian and me, young migrants, some of the thousands arriving every week in the biggest, brashest city in Asia to start new lives, to be someone, make fortunes, create new identities, or to hide. Back in Shenyang, I'd sometimes felt like a special secret visitor. Here, I was utterly insignificant. This realization was alienating and exciting at the same time. Here, perhaps I could be anyone I wanted to be. The year I arrived, about 17 million people were living in this megalopolis, of which the ethnic Korean population was small, about 80,000. About a third of those were South Korean expatriates. The rest were Korean Chinese, as I was pretending to be. Ian and I headed straight to a district called Longbai, where there was a small, prospering Korean town. By the end of the same day, it was our great good fortune to find a cramped, shabby two-room apartment for a modest monthly rent without any deposit required. It had a tiny hot plate, a leaking sink, and a view onto a construction site where illegal drilling and hammering went on through the night. We didn't care. We both felt we'd been given a new chance. You get three chances in life. This time, I'd seized one. My plan was to get a job in a restaurant until I found something better. Again, everything seemed to happen at once. Nothing stood still in Shanghai. Within a day, Ian and I both got work in the same nearby restaurant. I was at the counter, she waited tables. To mark this new start, I changed my name again. This time I decided to call myself Che In Hee. My fifth name. I had told too many people in Shenyang I was North Korean. I needed to bury the name Sun Hyang. Ian was incredulous. Eh? Why? What's wrong with Sun Hyang? The fortune teller said this name would bring me luck. I had become an accomplished liar, even to the people who thought they were close to me. By day, the skyscrapers of Lujiazui were grey and blurred in a haze of smog. By night, they were glittering displays of colour and crystal, each with a distinct character of its own, their summits forming atolls of light in the clouds, their bases competing for attention with vast moving images, of a soccer ball kicked into a goal by a Nike shoe, of Coca-Cola being poured into a glass of sparkling LED bubbles. One evening, not long after I arrived, I went window shopping along the exclusive strip on Huaihailu, wandering through the golden glow of displayed diamond jewellery and luxury Western brand watches. I realised that I wasn't simply in another country. I was in another universe from the one where I'd grown up. Money was the obsession here, and celebrity and fame. I had dreaded the curiosity of others about my past, but in Shanghai, no one cared where you were from, as long as you weren't illegal. Fortunes were being made overnight in property, stocks and retail. The city opened its doors to those with nerve, ambition and talent. It was uncaring and cruel to those with no right to be here. If I was to get out of waitressing, I needed what every illegal in the city craved, a legitimate ID card. The absence of this small vital item was what barred me from opportunity. Without an ID, there was no chance of better paid, more meaningful work. Over the next few months, I made discreet inquiries among the waitresses in Koreatown. Many illegals were drawn to the glamour of Shanghai, and restaurants were often where they found their first jobs. Some of these girls must have obtained IDs somehow. A few of them admitted to me that their IDs were fakes, but I was wary of acquiring a fake. It was a dangerous thing to possess if the police checked it. The safest option was to buy a real ID from someone. For that, I would need a broker. The first broker I met, a contact of one of these waitresses, asked for the equivalent of $16,000. I told him to forget it. The second one asked for even more. The predicament reminded me of the gang in Chiang Mai. Anyone who knew I was an illegal was going to take advantage. They would fleece me for as much as they could get and feel little motivation to help me. To avoid the gangsters, I needed a better tactic. I needed to make up a story. A mild, fresh spring turned to the torpor of summer in my first year in Shanghai. I was cooling off after work in an ice cream parlour with Ian, when a man at the next table tried to flirt with us. He was a Korean-Chinese in his 30s, with his own shop in Koreatown. He was slightly tipsy, I realised. Somehow, the conversation got on to his aunt.
"She's a marriage broker for women wanting to marry South Korean men," he said. "Can you believe that?"
Instinctively, I sensed a possibility. "I wish I could study in South Korea," I said. Ian turned to stare at me as if I'd grown a second head. "But I'm too old for a student visa. I need to make myself a few years younger somehow."
"With a new ID," he said, finishing my thought.
Perhaps he was trying to impress two pretty girls in an ice cream parlour, but he was suddenly eager to help.
"Let me ask her for you. Let's see what she says."
He took my phone number. Weeks passed. Summer stretched far into September, and then to a mild and pleasant autumn, and I forgot about the man in the ice cream parlour. Then in November, near the end of my first year in the city, an unfamiliar number called my phone. It took me a minute to figure out what the woman at the other end was on about. It was the aunt of the man from the ice cream parlour. She asked me to visit her in Harbin. She would sort me out with a new ID.
"Thank you," I said. "Harbin? Where is that?"
"1,000 miles from Shanghai, in the far northeast. That's where," Ian said when I asked her.
She had a good laugh about that. I lied to the manager of the restaurant, saying that my mother was sick in hospital and that I had to see her. I bought a train ticket to Harbin. The journey to the northeast took almost 2 days. I arrived from the mild Shanghai winter, totally underdressed for the snowed under below freezing northeast. I stayed in Harbin just 2 hours, long enough to meet a tiny lady so muffled in fur she looked like some woodland animal, have an official photo taken, then catch a train back. A month later, an envelope arrived through the mail at my apartment. I opened it and held in my hands my own ID card. My new name was Park Sun-ja. Sun-ja. I sighed. My sixth name. The identity had belonged to a Korean-Chinese girl, who, the lady in Harbin told me, had a mental illness. Her parents wanted to raise money for her care by selling her ID. It had cost me all the money I had saved in Shanghai, but now I was legal. Or at least I could pass for legal with little fear of discovery. As if sensing my new status, within days the city was lifting the curtain on a much brighter side of life.
Chapter 31. Career Woman. About a week after receiving my ID, I found a job that paid almost four times what I earned as a waitress. I became an interpreter and secretary at a South Korean tech company that made compact discs and LED lights. Its office was in Koreatown. My boss was one of the South Korean directors, and part of my role was to accompany him on visits to clients and manufacturing plants. I noticed that the Chinese looked up to South Koreans and addressed them respectfully. I had usually known them to scowl down their noses at North Koreans. Everything had happened so fast. Overnight, I had gone from waiting tables to sitting in boardrooms, interpreting in negotiations, learning how a modern company operated, and the culture in which business was conducted. I was meeting clients and buyers from Taiwan and Malaysia, and mingling socially with South Korean co-workers. The friends I'd made while waitressing knew me as Inhee. In my new job, I used the name on my ID card and documentation, Sunja. I would have to take care that these two worlds never collided. The company's products were manufactured in a plant that was modern even by Shanghai standards. The process was kept entirely dust-free. To enter, we passed through a special machine that blew contaminants from our clothing. The South Koreans treated me well. I could not bear to imagine their reaction if they'd known I'd grown up in the bosom of their archenemy. At times, this felt surreal. We were all Koreans, sharing the same language and culture, yet we were technically at war. I began to relax and enjoy life a little. I felt financially more secure, though there was still the enormous debt to my uncle, which I repaid in monthly instalments. I started to dress as nicely as I could afford. I noticed how the businesswomen I saw along Nanjing Lu judged their clothes well and carried stylish accessories. I took driving lessons and got my driver's license. The rent on our apartment became too high for Ian. She moved out, and I kept the place to myself. I felt more confident. I no longer lived in the shadows. The cloud in my sky was the absence of my family. It was now more than 5 years since that last call from my mother. That ache of longing I felt had not lessened. After the ordeal with the gang, I was frightened of returning to Changbai. I had no plan. A sense of profound resignation crept over me. The path that led me back to my mother and brother was becoming darker and fainter with time. I wasn't even sure I'd find it again. I was 22 years old. If I'd stayed in North Korea, I'd have graduated from Haesan Economic School by now. I'd probably have a government job in Haesan like my mother, a house on the river, and a network of trading contacts shared with my uncles and aunts. Would that have been so bad? I pushed such thoughts from my mind. I now felt safe enough with my new identity to eat at two restaurants in Shanghai that were owned and operated by North Korea. One of them, near my home in Koreatown, was the Morangak. The other, in the downtown Jiango Hotel, was the Pyongyang Omonyugwan, where I went often. These restaurants were foreign currency earners for whichever bureau of the party in Pyongyang operated them. The waitresses were selected for their loyalty, their songbun, and their beauty. Because they were popular with South Koreans, I suspected also that they provided cover for Puibu agents spying on overseas Korean communities. The first time I walked into the Pyongyang Omonyugwan and sat down, I felt I was back home. The wait-